Seriously though, whenever we talk about stuff that isn't exactly Lord of the Rings, I'm always hoping like the listener just kind of gets the idea, like, oh, you know, I kind of got an itch to go watch this movie that Patrick and Clifford were talking about. Probably start.
Indeed. I like that though.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah. Hopefully, maybe I'll cut in what we were playing later in the episode.
Okay.
All right, Clifford, how you been?
Pretty good. How about yourself, Patrick?
I've been good. What are we at here? Chapter 16 of The Hobbit?
Indeed, we are. A Thief in the Night.
Yeah, we're working through. We're working through, dude.
Yeah.
It's pretty sweet. Pretty sweet.
Are we doing any time or
we do Clifford, come on, you should know by now. At the beginning we do vague time references that can't actually say what's going on.
Okay,
so how are you? And you say something like good.
Real vague. The other thing I was gonna say is I ran 20 miles this morning before work.
Oh yeah, you got the marathon coming.
Got up at 5 AM and ran for 3 hours and it was pretty tough.
When's the marathon?
2 weeks.
Okay, so maybe by the time this comes out, at the end we can say how you did.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah. Austin Marathon, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Nice, nice. You go. What's the goal? A PR?
Not this year. I mean, I would love to say yes, but I have not been training anywhere near enough.
What kind of attitude is that?
Pardon?
What kind of attitude is that?
The attitude of not a champion.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into it then. Yeah. Cliff's notes.
Indeed. So, the dwarves at the start of the chapter get word that Dane and his dwarf army are only 2 days' march from the mountain. Roach, which is the raven we've met in the last chapter, counsels them to seek peace because winter is coming and the elves and men are far too numerous. Thorin becomes obsessed with the Arkenstone, finally revealing to the group that he desires it, wants everyone to seek it out, and will avenge anyone who hides it from him. Hearing this, Bilbo is afraid, but resolves to do something crazy. During his lookout shift in the night, he sneaks out of the fortress and into the camp of elves and men, where he appears before Bard and the Elven King. They're dubious of him, but he presents the Elven King to them as a bargaining chip, knowing that it'll make Thorin compromise. Bard and the Elven King are honored and impressed and send him on his way. On his way out of their camp, Bilbo passes Gandalf, who congratulates him, and Bilbo's certainly very grateful, but he hurries back to his post nonetheless.
Right on. Cool.
I'd say this was a surprising episode. Maybe not the most action-packed, but this turn of events took me by surprise.
It was another quick chapter. It was only like, I don't know, my book is only like, honestly, like 7 pages again. I don't know. All these past few chapters have been extremely short.
They've been seeming like in a game of chess. Each chapter is like a single move.
Yeah, I kind of like the short chapters. Not gonna lie, you know.
Yeah, lots kind of cool.
Lots of stuff going on. So yeah. It's also kind of cool. All right. We didn't do what we're gonna talk about today. All
right. Do you want to give us a quick outline?
Oh, yeah. So today we'll talk about Dane and his army and what Thorin's crazy plans are with that. We'll talk about how Bilbo's betrayal, which you were already mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about Gandalf. Did you mention him yet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry. I zone out when you say that. No offense. And then we got two steps on the hero's journey to talk about. So that'll be a good time.
Exciting.
Yeah. All right. So, well, let's start with I guess Dane's army.
Yeah. So my first question reading this, the first news of the chapter that Dane is coming with his army, which certainly Thorin's happy about, but made me think, does Dane even stand a chance against the men and elves? We heard he has got 500 dwarves, they're 2 days away, but this huge host is between them and this secret passage into the mountain. Or not even secret, narrow walkway up to the mountain.
Yeah, like you said, 500 dwarves, 2 days away. Now, the one thing was, when Bilbo went to go meet with Bard and the Elven King, they apparently had no idea that the dwarves were near. So, I guess they somehow had the element of surprise going, but Bilbo ruined that.
Well, surprise maybe, but surely once the dwarves were a day away or a half day away, they would know.
Well, I think 500 dwarves with surprise could do a lot of damage to the Elven King and Bard's armies.
Fair.
Yeah, especially fair. Bard's army. You know, it's just men who have no homes.
Those could be some pretty vicious men. You never know.
Or they're tired and weak, or I don't know. Well, no, yeah. Well, anyways, yeah. They're probably spot.
Don't we know that? Yeah, they're outnumbered, certainly.
Yeah, and I think the biggest deal is, you know, the Raven Roak himself already said it. He said, like, you know, even if these dwarves somehow break through, which I guess it sounds unlikely. The bottom line is, even if you have victory, then you have no friends to, like, give you food or anything, so you're going to starve throughout the winter. So, like,
right.
So whether they stand a chance or not, you know, it's not very productive to have an army of dwarves go fight men and elves. Is really the bottom line there, you know?
Right. So if Dane and his dwarves can't, or we'd say are pretty outnumbered going up against the men and elves, and they can't get to the mountain without passing the men and elves, it seems to me like we're at an impasse.
Correct.
Like something's got to give. My other thought is, speaking of starving in the winter, is Thorin actually crazy enough that he would rather starve than give up his treasure? Because he certainly seems hell-bent on that when the ravens warn him again not to do this.
I would say yes, actually. I think Thorin is crazy enough to do that. But I think he's definitely counting on Dane to show up unexpectedly to intimidate the elves and men to back off. Like, I think he's thinking that that's going to work out. And
right. I guess that's where I see, like you were saying, the dwarves might do some damage if they surprise them. But if this is going to be, like, really a bargaining game and not an actual battle, as soon as the dwarves show up to kind of pose a threat, the men and elves are going to be like, oh, wait a second, we've got you outnumbered.
Yeah, but Thorin's got all the gold. If it comes to a battle, I don't know. You know, like, I mean, Bard and the elves didn't attack the only 14 people guarding the treasure. So then now, right, if there's 514 people who want to protect the treasure, they already weren't fighting 14. Why would they fight 514?
Yeah, yeah. It makes sense.
I mean, yeah. Just continuing on Thorin's craziness, there is a line that he stated in there. If you want to. There is a line in there. What was the line?
For the Arkenstone of my father is worth more than a river of gold in itself, and to me it is beyond price. That stone of all the treasure I name unto myself, and I will be avenged on anyone who finds it and withholds it.
Oh, watch out, Bilbo, on that one, right?
No kidding. Yeah, so Bilbo seems to be in a lot of danger there.
I know.
And angry Thorin, who is, I mean, doesn't seem like the, not someone you want to be on the bad side, and then not to mention when he's totally starved and gold crazy. Sounds like bad news bears. Like, this Thorin might be the most dangerous that he's been in the whole story at this point.
Yeah, and I think Bilbo's pretty ballsy to, you know, just keep on with whatever little plan he's hatching. I think we'll talk about Bilbo's perspective in a little bit. But yeah, that whole line, it sounds like we talked about the Mathros and Maglor, how they had to like chase down the Silmarils because it was like their family oath and their dad had.
Right. This, for a little recap for folks, this is from the Silmarillion. These are the sons of Fëanor.
Right. Yes.
So the sons of the elf who made the Silmarils, these beautiful jewels, and they basically took a family oath that at all costs they have to go after the Silmarils, even if it means breaking bonds of friendship or family or what have you.
Right.
They have
to. Yeah, and this line sounded like straight out of that. straight.
Like, this treasure is worth more to me than anything.
Yeah, this could have been Fëanor himself saying this.
So, what is the Arkhan Stone? Well, I mean, we've talked a little bit about it before, but is it sort of a dwarf version of the Silmaril? Is it that important?
Yeah, I think that's what we were deciding. I think in one of the episodes, I might have
already asked you this question.
Yeah, in one of the episodes, we were talking about whether the Arkhan Stone was a Silmaril. I'm saying no, but he was writing more refining Silmarillion stories, really, at this time. So I think I slipped in one of the episodes and said the Silmaril is based off the Arkhan Stone, but it's really the Arkhan Stone is probably based off one of the Silmarils. That desire for some sort of great jewel, and like the lust for a jewel. Yeah, that's
so we don't know necessarily how it relates on an absolute level to the whole Middle Earth mythology, but specific to the Hobbit, this is the be-all end-all of the jewels.
Yeah, and it's definitely, I mean, it's just the sign of authority of the mountain.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is the heart of the mountain.
Yeah, it's the heart of the mountain, and they said somewhere else, it's basically, it's Thorin's heart at this point, too. You know, this is what he wants most. He's openly telling the dwarves, hey, everybody's looking for this. Like, we've already heard references that Thorin was looking for it, but now he's ordering everybody to, hey, start looking for this thing. Like, where is it, you know?
Yeah, which was a big shift, right? Because before he was doing it in secret because he didn't want someone else to find it. And now he's like, find it for me. And if you find it and don't tell me, I'm going to kill you.
Then again, though, it's like, I mean, if you try to get into Thorin's head, it's like, well, where the hell is this thing? At this point, you know, why would Smaug hide it somewhere away from all his treasure? I mean, unless they've somehow gotten to the bottom of that huge, like, if you assume that everything was clumped into one really big pile, I mean, you know, he's probably, why wouldn't it have been somewhere somewhat front and center or something, or, you know.
In an alternate plot, I could have imagined, though, that it was so important and so, like, Smaug recognized it as the most valuable, and so he, like, swallowed it or something. Or, like, kept it on him at all times, and then it went to the bottom of the lake with him.
Ooh, good idea, Clifford. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good thought, but I think it's more realistic. It's more realistic, I think, that it would stay with the dragon's treasure as opposed to on the dragon itself.
Certainly. Point being, Bilbo's in danger. So this brings us to Bilbo taking a huge risk in this chapter. First of all, he's taking a risk not telling Thorin, hey, by the way, I've got the Arkhan Stone under my pillow. Although on that note, I'll say, do you think Bilbo would, like, he's this far in at this point, would he get off clean just walking up to Thorin at the start of the chapter and be like, oh, you wanted that? Oh, by the way, it's been in my pocket the whole time, you know?
Well, okay, so I was thinking about this. All right, well, I kind of want to spoil something here, because...
Okay, we'll come back to that then.
Okay, we'll come back to that.
So, Bilbo's betrayal. Not only does he not tell Thorin that he's got the Arkhan Stone on him, but he sneaks out in the middle of the night. He lies to Bomber, I think, and says, hey, I'll take over the night shift. And while he does that, he climbs over the little wall they've made to the cave with the Arkhan Stone in hand and slips invisibly into the camp of the elves where... He kind of lets himself get discovered and taken in front of their masters. All of a sudden, he's got this plan in mind. But, yeah, what did you make of it? Good choice? Totally honorable? It seemed to me like probably one of the hardest things he's done in the story so far.
See, I kind of disagree with that. I think it was relatively easy to do, because they made some sort of reference that he was kind of sitting on his plan for a couple days, like he was thinking about this, brooding over it. Okay. And, you know, he was so bored in the mountain and everything was so deadlocked that he's just like, you know, I'm sick of this. I want to, let's end this, or let's get things, let's shake things up at least, you know? So and I mean, Bilbo, he's much braver than when we started the book. So, I mean, this isn't as bold as walking into a dragon's lair by himself to see a live dragon. He's just, he is kind of betraying his friends. So, I mean, that's hard to do, but he's on friendly terms with all of them. They all owe him. They're endeared to him. So I think it's just hard that he's breaking a friendship, but it's not like it's something scary and like maybe it's life-threatening because Thorin's, you know, spewing all this, you know, I'll hold anybody that withholds or kill anybody that withholds it from me, or, you know, but I mean, it's, I think it's just something hard to do as opposed to dangerous or life-threatening to do, kind of, in my opinion. Okay. Yeah, but anyways, he does go and meet with them, so let's talk about this meeting a little bit. I thought Bilbo handled himself extremely well for the whole meeting with Bard and the Elven King.
Yeah, he seemed very on top of it.
Even meeting the elves that were on guard to take him, kind of in quotes, captive, you know?
Yeah, he was. He didn't even hesitate. He's like, I'm not screwing around here. Take me to your king, and I'll talk to him. This. I don't think he said your life depends on it, but it was like, this is of the utmost importance, and you will do what I say.
Yeah, and I think that's probably because Bilbo held all the cards here, obviously, because he had the Arkenstone, you know? So he was in command.
He holds the one card.
Yeah, the one card that matters. Yeah. We've talked about this a lot before, but this is another example where Bilbo's talking, he comes into this conversation, and he's talking about his contract with the dwarves, and he's talking about shares and profits, and he's like, oh, this is like my 1/14th of the treasure or whatnot. So this is, again, like, those are all kind of just modern thinking with, like, contracts and profits. It's, like, very business-like stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. So Bilbo, the modern character, is doing that.
That's true. That's a good point that you make, because I was going to say, wait a second. The division of profits makes a lot of sense to me. It doesn't feel all that modern. But Bilbo, kind of approaching it from the outset, like without even being challenged, he says to Bard, you know, I recognize that like my contract is on profits, not revenue, basically. Like he kind of immediately introduces a more modern element to this sort of ancient binding contract that he entered into in the beginning.
Right, yeah.
Which, lest we beat a dead horse, is what Thorin is functioning off of. Like, Thorin's going off of this sort of ancient, well, I would say Thorin's gone past the point of honor, but in Thorin's mind, he's functioning off like an ancient understanding. The mountain is his, the treasure is his, therefore he's not going to give it up. There is no compromise.
And Bilbo's talking with Bard here, and Bard is kind of the same mindset as Thorin, like the heroic. You know, he, so far, like, throughout the couple chapters that we've known Bard, the whole time he sounded, like, nobly proud and valiant, you know? And so now the modern character Bilbo's interacting with that, you know, and Bard's more good-hearted than Thorin at this point, but, I don't know, when I was reading this, I kept writing, like, Bard seems, like, blockheadedly simple, you know?
Yes, and Bilbo makes a point to point out how suspicious he is.
Yeah, it wasn't even like Bard was really thinking. He's like, fine, let Thorin rot if he wants to sit on his treasure. Like, we can do this all year. And it's like, well, your people have to guard the treasure in the middle of winter. I mean, you know, you guys are going to have problems too. And you guys weren't even aware that Dane's army is coming. It's like, you know, you're so obsessed with, like, kind of like honor or what's owed to you, or, you know, like the current circumstances, that it's like you're not good negotiators whatsoever. You know, there's nothing savvy about what you're doing.
Bard, you're saying Bard is sinking to Thorin's level.
Not quite, because I mean, Thorin's just crazy. Thorin's a crazy person at this point. Yeah, agree. But like, Bard's just like his old heroic style isn't. It's not good for good negotiations. Like, that's period. Uh-huh. And it's like, it's not savvy. It's not cunning. It's not, I don't know, robust. Or It's not clever. I mean, it's just extremely straightforward, blunt, and to the point. And that's not what's needed here. You know, you need to like shake things up and like come at this situation from a different angle. And like Bard doesn't seem at all capable of that.
Bard wants it to be a game of willpower, basically.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, like that's what's part of like is a draw to him, and that's what makes him like an actual hero, is that he's just pretty straightforward, noble. He'll do the right thing all the time. But, you know, when somebody else isn't doing the right thing, he's just going to, you know, stick to the good path without doing, I don't know. He's, you know, he can't shake things up like how Bilbo is doing it here. Because, you know, Bilbo comes and he's going to give the Arkenstone here.
Well, nevertheless, they were totally stunned when Bilbo presented it to them.
Right. So that, there's a couple things going on there. So the first thing we got to note, big thing, maybe we should treat this, I don't know. Well, we can treat this now. I mean, first of all, we'll come back to Bard and the Elven King a little bit, but like just the fact that Bilbo's standing over this Arkenstone.
Mm-hmm.
So if Bilbo had ever had any sort of dragon sickness curse on him, because we kind of thought about that, like, you know, he didn't tell the dwarves that he had the Arkenstone and everything, you know, and it seems like...
And he's clearly been a little bit more resistant to dragon sickness than the dwarves have, but we don't know that
it seems like everybody Bard, Elven King, Thorin, and the dwarves have all sort of been susceptible to the dragon sickness, to want part of the gold or something. But since Bilbo's given up the Arkenstone here, this kind of shows like, well, he's cured. Bilbo's good. He's out. He's done it. He's the whatever selfish thought the dragon sickness had on Bilbo, he's getting rid of it, as he's going to give over this Arkenstone here. So that's pretty cool. So
I don't mean to imply that this is like explicitly Christian, but do you see, like, is Tolkien making any Christian references there? Like, it feels to me like a kind of saints absolving themselves of worldly things in a very spiritual way, like the willingness to give up the most important. Not that Bilbo's seeing this as the most important thing, but a willingness to give up something so important in a situation for the greater good, basically. Like, he's looking well beyond himself. Feels like a pretty distinctly saintly thing to do.
See, I kind of agree with that, where it's, you know, he's staking this as his 1/14th of the treasure that he wants to give up.
Right.
Though Thorin kind of explicitly said, like, hey, nobody else has rights to this. Though that was after Bilbo had already quietly claimed it without telling the dwarves that he claimed it as his 1/14th.
True. And Bilbo was the first in the cave.
Right. Yeah, so that I can kind of see. Maybe, yeah, it's kind of like that. Bilbo's doing that, you know, and he just wants to resolve all conflict. He doesn't care what he gets out of it. So, yeah, sure. Is that saintly, or is that how, like, everybody should kind of aspire to be in any sort of religious context ever?
Perhaps. Yeah, perhaps you're right. I specifically like the... I don't know. Yeah, like the sacrificial nature of it felt very religious.
Yeah, for sure. Like, and I don't really disagree with you, but, you know, if we're talking like technically, like who owns what and who has rights to what, who deserves what, or who inherits what, I mean, that's another question here, and I feel like we could just put all the Christian ones on pause for a little bit and just think, like, well, was this actually Bilbo's to give? Because Bilbo kind of admits, you know, afterwards, like, I can't technically say I'm allowed to give this, but I'm saying this is my share, you know? So it's like, was Bilbo in the right to even give this thing away is, you know, my question.
Well, I think that's I'd throw this in the basket with, like, this is a modern interpretation of the situation. Like, he was right to give it away, but it wasn't his to give.
Right.
Is what we gather. Like, he basically admits that he's a thief. The title of the chapter is A Thief in the Night. But Bilbo acknowledges, like, I'm doing this, I've done a wrong for the sake of a larger right. And we assume, at least I assume, the fact that Gandalf congratulates him afterwards sort of, like, vindicates him. Like, if we think of Gandalf as, like, a kind of consistent or stable metric of, like, goodness throughout the story, if Gandalf is like, good job, Bilbo, like, it kind of implies to me, like, you did the right thing, kid.
But then you sound like, okay, he's doing something wrong to do a larger right. I mean, that's a pretty unchristian thing to say. Ends justify the means at close to any point.
Well, that's what I mean. Is like, I feel like that's a more modern interpretation. Like, that's a modern aspect to, like, like he's breaking some of these ancient codes. Like I feel like the more traditional understanding would be like you can't give something that's yours. Like the understanding of possession is maybe stronger than it would override
whatever. All right, well, what I would say is I agree that, you know, an old heroic person like Bard would never do what Bilbo's doing. You know, this is too, you know, Bard's right. too straightforward and simple and in the best noble way possible. Whereas Bilbo, right. you know, he's more modern and he's like, all right, I'm willing to do whatever. And then I think Gandalf's Vindication says that the ends justify the means in this case, but like, it's more like kind of back to the Maglor and Methros thing, like they did so many terrible things that they had no claim to the Silmarils anymore. Just by all morality, that you guys don't get to inherit these. So I feel like it's the same thing here. Like, right. Thorin's acting like such a crazy asshole that he doesn't get to have the... By rights, you don't get this, you know? Even, like, the old rights. By old rights, even, you know, or old codes, you don't deserve this. I feel like Gandalf's the metric in that case.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. I'm hesitant to say the ends justify the means.
Well, yeah, so but I guess I didn't mean to bring up Gandalf prematurely, but before we dive into Gandalf more, the other thing that I was just thinking about while you're talking is Bilbo was brought on to the expedition as a burglar.
Okay.
That's been his title all along, and they mention it numerous times throughout, is like, oh, the burglar, why don't you go do some burglaring for us? And they kind of... Like, technically, he steals a single piece of treasure from Smaug when he goes down for the first time, and that enrages Smaug. And the dwarves are happy to see some single golden chalice. But that amounts to nothing. Like, relative to the entirety of the treasure, what Bilbo has stolen so far is pretty negligible. And, of course, there's, like, minor acts of burglary throughout all of his adventures, like stealing a key from the Elven guard in the palace in the woods, etc. But as of yet, this has been the most critical thing that he's stolen.
Yeah, you're right. This is his biggest burglary. You're definitely right on that.
Yeah, and at least what it seems, we don't know what's going to happen, but what it seems to be setting it up for is like, this is the burglary that's kind of saves the day, which implies to me that Gandalf saw something like this coming. Maybe not the specifics, but Gandalf is giving Bilbo the bravo because Bilbo is functioning as a burglar in his highest sense, or like his highest and best use type thing.
Yeah, dude, we gotta hold off on that till we talk about Gandalf.
Okay, though. Okay. I'll punch.
Well, yeah,
I'll punch.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Well, here's the other thing, though. Okay, so whether Bilbo's doing the right thing or not, I think we can all kind of agree morally he's doing the right thing. You know, with Gandalf's vindication, maybe we can say he's actually doing the right thing even in this situation. Like, not even just ends justify the means. It's like, no, this is the correct means. Like, this is the good means to do, you know? I think we can go far enough to even say that. But, you know, then the Elven King's like, tells Bilbo, hey, you should stay here. Will you be safe? And we'll also honor you thrice over or something. So then it's like, okay, well, should Bilbo really be honored? Because what he's doing is very traitorous, you know? I mean, yes, he's doing the right thing, but should he really be honored for being a traitor? I don't know. You know, that's kind of the question. And that's a question, like, that comes down to every single snitch story ever. Even if the snitch is, like, snitching on drug dealers in court.
And that's why I feel like there's a redeeming quality to the fact that Bilbo returns back to the dwarves. Because, you know, some part of the Elven King and Bard's offer, they're like, oh my god, you're a hero, we're going to take care of you, you don't have to go back there, like, you're a refugee at this point, we'll take care of you. That could easily be the product of the Elven King being kind of in awe of this treasure that has fallen in his lap. Right?
Right.
Like, independent of where the story's going, or independent of what the, like, higher purpose is, Bard and the Elven King now have an amazing piece of treasure that they didn't before. That felt like a... Although it's friendly, it's not proper. And we don't know why they're making that offer. Like, it could be kind of empty or half-hearted or what have you. Because it's based solely on the fact that Bilbo has given them a thing and they're just trying to give him a thing back. And Bilbo's choice to return to the dwarves makes him feel like much less of a traitor to me. It's like he was committed to a cause, he fulfilled that cause, but he's not trying to get out of the situation or anything like that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's extremely noble that Bilbo decides to go back to the dwarves there, as opposed to just enjoy the honors of switching sides like any traitor in America. Right. The obvious example would be like Benedict Arnold or something, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, Bilbo just ultimately made the right choice that, hey, I don't even need the honor. I'm just going to go back and be loyal to my friends, you know? And literally, it almost came down to partly just like, hey, I said I'd stay on watch for Bomber, you know? I'm not going to let Bomber down and get crap from Thorin because, you know, Bilbo escaped in the night because of his laziness.
Right. Certainly. Well, okay, let me frame it another way then. We say it's the right thing to do, and we think that it's pretty honorable that he did that. Was it smart? And... well, okay. First of all, was it smart?
No. Are you, you're gonna go back to Thorin? What he said? No.
Right. Seems like pretty blatantly threatening his own life.
Yeah.
And...
but you know, he's threatening his own life, but he's like, he doesn't even care at this point. He's just, he knows what's the right thing to do. He's gonna do it. That's sweet. That's honorable.
Yeah. Right.
That's honorable highest way possible, not just like duty kind of honor. It's like no, morally right honorable.
Yeah, certainly. And the other thing that maybe cynical or out of the story me is like, well, of course it makes for a way better story if he goes back. Like if he were to stay in the elven and the camp of the elvish and army of men, like the story might keep going, but Bilbo would be removed as a character.
Yeah.
He'd be sitting next to the fire in one of those tents while Bard and the Elven King went and did some bargaining, and then he would go home and that would be the story.
That's true. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's like maybe it wasn't smart, but like that's kind of a key driver of the plot at this point is like the fact that Bilbo went back.
No, but I think like at this point it's in Bilbo's character that he would go back to.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, you don't have to be that cynical, Clifford.
Okay. So I have two questions for you.
Okay.
Would you have given away the Arkenstone?
What's the other question?
Would you have gone back to the dwarf camp after giving it away?
The second one, I think maybe I would have returned. But would I have given the Arkenstone away? No, I would have given it to Thorin when he said, I'm going to kill anybody that has it. Like, I would have been too intimidated and be like, all right, here you go, dude. Like, I don't think anybody could really be blamed in that situation. And I don't know, Thorin's just crazy at this point. So I would, I wouldn't mess with that. What about you?
Well, of course I want to say that I would have given away the Arkenstone.
Well, I wanted to say that too, but I was honest. here's the other deal about, sorry, before you get to yours, here's the other deal too. I would not have said, oh yeah, I've been holding it for 2 weeks since, you know, we originally got into this cave. I would have tried to somehow figure out some sort of lie to be like, yeah, I found it in the bathroom over here. I don't know why I was there, but here it is, you know? Like I would have pretended like I had just found it. I'm very, I'll tell everybody right now, I'm very aware that would not work out for me. But, but that's what I would try to do, if I'm being completely honest. Yeah. All right, so what about you?
I guess I'd say my reasonable self sitting here in a chair right now doing a podcast is like, no, probably I would not have given away the Arkenstone to the men and the elves. I probably would have turned it over to Thorin or maybe hidden it somewhere.
So you would have tried to keep it for yourself, even from Thorin?
No. Like I would have wanted to rid my hands of it, like not be involved in the conflict, basically. I would consider myself sort of conflict averse.
Well, I think both of us aren't considering the lust of a jewel that's that glowing and powerful. Like, maybe we would have actually desired it ourselves. I don't think we're...
Nah, dude, I got an iPhone.
Alright, if you say
so. No, anyways, what I was going to say is that that's me sitting here right now, but if I was in Bilbo's place where I was, like, intensely desperate and starving and hungry and frustrated and, like, probably started to value my own life in a different way. Not that Bilbo doesn't value his life at all, but I think he has like a different understanding of what his own life means and what he has to accomplish. I would be more inclined to do what Bilbo did.
You know what else I think is going on with Bilbo?
And I was going to say, I probably would be not very inclined to go back to the dwarf camp, But if I was crazy enough to give away the Arkham Stone, I'm probably crazy enough to go back.
Well, here's the other thought I just had about Bilbo at this point. You know, Remember how we were talking about how Gandalf, it seems like he, and we'll talk about, maybe this could be our transition into Gandalf here. But anyways, you know how like Gandalf in the earlier chapters, sometimes he would be doing stuff that's just like, man, Gandalf, that's kind of ballsy to lead the whole company to do this, you know. I guess you really just know things are going to work out, or you really trust in something that things are going to work out, you know. But, like, I mean, it's just crazy what you're doing, you know. And I feel like Bilbo, he's come so far with, like, his character development, and he himself has, like, grown so much that he might kind of be doing this now, too, to where, like, why don't I just keep doing the right thing? And I don't think that'll lead me astray.
Right. I agree.
But that said, I don't know. If I had to be reasonable, I probably would have, I would have given it over to Thorin. I think I would have cracked. I'll openly say that, yeah.
So, Gandalf. What of it? Where's he been?
Well, we don't know where he's been. You know, we're not going to do spoilers on this show.
Well, do you know where he's been?
Oh, I know where he's been. But anyways, yeah. So, we only get to see a little bit of him because Bilbo has to get rushed back, you know, because he's on, like, a time limit with this thing. Like you mentioned before, Gandalf gives him approval with everything that he's doing. And so, you know, that approval is enduring even more to Bilbo that he can get through whatever's coming next, because, you know, Bilbo's really not looking forward to go back to the dwarves camp, clearly. But he's definitely willing to do it, so that's cool. Gandalf's applaud and reassurance, and, you know, just the fact that, hey, Gandalf's back, I'd be super happy. Yeah, I am super happy as a reader. If I was Bilbo, I would be absolutely happy, you know? I mean, if Gandalf's around, things are good.
Yeah, you know? I mean, Gandalf is... I guess I take that back. I was going to say Gandalf seems like Bilbo's favorite character, but Bilbo was also pretty enamored with Elrond and with Bjorn for different reasons.
And and Bilbo's buds with certain dwarves at this point, like Balin and probably Keeley and Feely.
That's true.
Maybe even Bomber at this point. And Thorin, in a way. I mean, you know, then again, he completely knows that he's betraying Thorin at the deepest level possible at this point.
Not buds anymore.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
Point being, Bilbo has a lot of respect for Gandalf, looks up to him. So getting the pat on the back from Gandalf seems like a good sign no matter what.
Yeah, like...
No matter what you jump into.
Yeah.
That's a good send off.
Yeah, Gandalf's somebody he looks up to, and it's I would be grateful to have here like Gandalf giving me applause, like, hey, you're doing something right here, good job. Mm-hmm. There's a couple things that Gandalf's like alluding to or whatnot. You know, he talks about like information that the Ravens haven't heard, even, you know, and stuff.
I was gonna ask if this supposed information is good or bad or ugly.
I don't know. We can't talk about it as much because we're just going off like the little bit that we have here, but Gandalf specifically says like the whole end is near. So I mean, the immediate future of things, he was implying that it's not gonna be easy for Bilbo, but Gandalf thinks Bilbo will make it through all right.
Although, didn't in characteristic Gandalf fashion, didn't he say something like, you might just survive?
Yeah, so it's like, well, I mean, that's fun. It's leaving the door open, you know. But it seems like, you know, you might survive. So it's like, oh yeah, you could easily die, but I think you'll make it out all right, you know.
Yeah.
So, and then then he's alluding to something like, oh, there's information that even the Ravens haven't heard. I'm gonna hint at this because this will be a larger topic in Lord of the Rings, because we will actually answer this kind of questions. But it seems like, you know, is Gandalf trusting to luck? Like, we said that before, maybe he is. Or, you know, does he know what's going to happen? Like, can he actually see the future? Or does he have, like, some sort of feeling or intuition, like, he can just sense what's going to happen or whatnot? Like, he senses that not even the birds realize what's coming yet. Maybe he actually kind of does know. Like, maybe he has, like, more knowledge of what's going on in the surrounding lands than the birds are checking up on, you know.
Fair, yeah, because he might have come from a different direction.
But the sense, you know, just the feeling that kind of permeates off of Gandalf.
Something's in the water.
Yeah, and every single thing he ever says, ever.
Right.
So, to get to the bottom of that, that's another conversation, but I mean, yeah, that stuff's going on.
Okay. You alluded to some steps we may have taken on the hero's journey. I can be your hero, baby.
Yeah, Clifford. Indeed, you're right. So we got two steps here. Mm-hmm. All right, so for this one, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the steps. We're going to give a couple examples about each. I got some good examples tonight. But right. And then after that, we'll talk about how they both fit into The Hobbit, because I actually think we might have gone out of order, and maybe one of them doesn't fit perfectly, but we're going to do it.
Sounds good. All right.
So, the first step is the refusal of the return.
Hmm.
So you remember when we last left off...
Not to be confused with refusal of the call.
Yes, that's at the beginning. This one's towards the end. So, if you remember... Yeah, you
got that.
You know, if you're going to state it. You know, if you remember, the last hero step that we did was the ultimate boon. So, that's like... Boon, I think, might be like a physical like thing, like a trophy or a jewel or something, you know. Or, mm-hmm. But, you know, it could easily be symbolized like, you know, you made the massive achievement. You fulfilled what you were after. And so, we were saying, like, well, is that the death of Smaug? Or is that when Bilbo finds the Arkenstone, which is the heart of the mountain, which signifies that they have the treasure? All right. Mm-hmm. Up for debate. I think it's the Arkenstone because Bilbo actually did that one, as opposed to killing Smaug because Bilbo didn't do that. Anyways, though, refusal of the return is, after the quest is achieved, the adventurer must still return with his life-transmuting trophy. The hero must return back to his community with the renewing trophy slash boon, or, you know, as we're saying, like, whatever quality or, you know, credentials that now that he's accomplished it, you know, he's returning back, whatever. Mm-hmm. But frequently the responsibility has been refused. So that's where we're at.
So help me out. I'm a little lost there. What do you mean by the responsibility has been refused?
So you have to go back. So you're in, like, I did it. I won. I triumphed. And you're in, like, the state of bliss. But it has to end. You have to go back to the real world. It has to, you know, you have to go... After, you know, you can't just stay in, like, victory mode for the rest of your life.
So this is like, oh, wait, this isn't over.
Right. And, I mean, now, in some movies, like, what we were discussing, like, the ultimate boon is, like, the last scene of the movie. That's it, you know. Like, I think of, like, Rocky 1 at the end of that, you know. Like, the theme song's going on, you know, and that's it. And then the girl, Adrian, comes up to him, and they're just like, oh, yeah, they're going to get married, you know. Cause they're sad. Right. But, you know, but in some, many cases... You have to go back and, like, go back to the real world after that. And maybe it'll become clear if we describe some examples here.
Yes. Most definitely.
So, first example ever, of course, we're going to go to Star Wars. So, this is kind of... I think this is the point where Emperor's dead. Luke's on the Death Star with Vader. And Vader knows that he's dying. So, he tells Luke, hey, take off my mask. But Luke doesn't want to. Because he knows if he takes off Darth Vader's mask, Vader's going to die.
Okay, for context, real quick, just because I want to make sure I understand this. In this case, the boon would have been the killing of the Emperor, because he's the real bad guy.
Yeah, and then also, like, slightly like them blowing up the Death Star to just get rid of any Imperial threat.
Right.
But, I mean, that one technically hasn't happened yet, but it's literally in the process of happening.
Okay.
By Luke's friends. Luke doesn't directly do that, but yeah. I don't know. Okay. The ultimate boon probably for Luke specifically is Emperor's defeated, Dad's back and good guy. The Jedi has returned.
Understood.
Yeah. So now the Jedi's returned, and so, like, Luke's like, hey, Dad, I want to hang out. Like, let's be buds, and, you know, you can teach me the rest of the Jedi stuff or something. I don't know. I don't know. Well, you know, if it's your dad, you don't want to, like... You want to spend as long as you can with them, obviously.
Right.
But Vader already knows that he's dying, and so he's just like, hey, I want to see you with my own eyes. I don't want to have to rely on this machinery to keep me alive. So he's like, Luke, take off my mask. You know, we can't stop this process at this point. Let's finish this off. And Luke doesn't want to. So this is like the blissful moment where it's like, oh, this is perfect right now. I don't want this to end. But Luke's, but like, Vader's like, no, we gotta do it. We gotta end this. And so Luke's like, fine, all right, you know what? I guess I don't want to, but yeah, let's end. You know, this will end. So he takes out the mask. The dad gets to see him with his own eyes, and we get to see what Vader's like under the mask, and then that's it. But so Luke accepts that he has to return, but you know, at first there is the refusal, like, no, I don't want you to die.
Right. Certainly.
Yeah. So another example I was thinking of.
Okay.
I was going through my own handmade list of favorite movies. Where else? And I didn't actually see this one in many places.
Yeah, this was. I will say this is a weird one, or a hard one to find.
Right. Yeah. But anyways, one that I did come up with is Catch Me If You Can. You remember that movie? Mm-hmm. That movie's so sweet. Like, seriously, that movie's a 10 out of 10 just because it's like, well, what fault can you find with this movie? You know, like, I mean, this movie is just so, it's just a well-made movie. It's a great story. It was a real story even, which is even crazier. Mm-hmm. And the real story was even crazier than what they, like, they had to cut stuff out because it just would drag on the plot too long, you know?
Right.
So, but yeah, this is the one with Leo and Tom Hanks, you know, where the kid's the con artist and Tom Hanks is the FBI agent that's tracking him down and, like, the kid's forging a bunch of fake checks, you know? All right. So, Leo's been running around the whole movie and he's in so deep and he's like that he has to leave the country and he's running like he's in so deep that you know he just can't get away from this, like, so eventually the movie kind of ends with Tom Hanks, who's the FBI agent, he catches him for all the fraud checks that he's been using and flying all over the world as like faking as a pilot and a doctor and everything,
right?
And so that was almost honestly like that was kind of a blessing because Leo, whoever he was playing, I think it was Frank Abagnale, is the real guy. And so it's almost kind of a blessing that he's finally caught because it's like, all right, well, cool, I can finally end this crazy fake life that I've been running because, you know, I'm in so deep I can't get out of it without help or whatever, you know. So he goes to Tom Hanks, he goes to jail after trying to escape again anyways because it's the only thing he really knows at this point. And so he's with Tom Hanks and then he's sitting in jail and Tom Hanks like takes him and he's like, hey, you know, what do you think about this check? And he can tell all these forged checks because, you know, he's just the best at it. He was the king of it. You know, he was the first one to be doing this.
Right.
So then Tom Hanks kind of offers him a job at the FBI and, like, gives him kind of free rein. Like, all right, you got to do this boring office work, but you're doing a good thing here. You can return to normal life this way. And that's, at the end of the movie, he's seeing that and he's staring down like, okay, I can go back to normal life. I could do this. But he's seeing it and it's like, man, this is gonna be really boring, this is gonna be kind of torturous, like I could go back to this crazy adventurous life, I have the opportunity now. So is this really a refusal or is this like a temptation to go back? I don't know. So this might not be the perfect example, but you know, he sees the normal life and he doesn't really want to return to it because he's about to go and escape. And Tom Hanks is even like, all right, you know what? Like, he meets him at an airport. He's like, all right, I'll let you go. You know, you can go do this, but then I'm going to have to hunt you down, and then this is your last shot here. And so what does he do? You know? And so it's kind of like he has the opportunity to live a good and normal life, a safe life that's not crazy and, like, where he's in over his head.
Right.
But doesn't want to do it. So this is kind of like the refusal again. It's not quite, because it's more like a temptation to go back, to revert back to your bad ways, but...
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. Anyways, good news is he does end up returning to work on Monday, you know, and goes back to the grind and does the right thing, which is good.
So he accepts the return.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, the refusal to return is a step. I guess we're doing the step and then we're showing how they do return in most cases.
Yeah, I that's a tricky one,
right?
That last example, because he's like an anti-hero.
Right, it is tricky.
Like his personal heroism is like opposite society.
I mean, heroic. Yeah. It's kind of confusing, but like I think the key to this step is you have to go back to normal life, and at some point they refuse. But and you know, like that is the step is like the refusal part of it. But then ultimately, we kind of already know because you know they're a hero that yeah they'll actually do it. They will return to it.
Mm-hmm. So what this makes me think of, I don't have a specific one in mind. But, like, a lot of kind of corny James Bond movies or James Bond situations where he's, like, with whatever his lover of the moment is. And then it's like, oh, shoot. And he gets pulled back into the plot and has to finish things off. But that's, like, I guess the way you were describing it is, like, this, like, kind of momentary bliss as part of the technically.
Yeah, it has to come after the climax.
Right. There's like, I know you've kind of won the day, and there's like a like this moment of like everything's perfect now, but then you sort of get pulled back into it. The other thing I was thinking is like, I think a lot of stories, it's specifically like I was thinking like superhero stories. Batman might be a good example. There's like a blurring of refusal of the return and refusal of the call. Like the beginning and end of the story are similar, right? Because the story might start with like, this is maybe superhero movies where the superhero is older. The story starts with like, we need your help. And whoever the person is like, I'm done with that now. I've moved past that in my life. Yada, yada. And then they get pulled back into the drama.
Kind
of. That seems like a classic thing to me. But that's refusal of the call.
Yeah.
But I feel like a similar thing plays out sometimes at the end of the story where you've got a refusal to return that's post-climax.
Or in the last movie of a series that usually plays out, I think.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Right.
Which personally, this is just a complete personal note. I usually like that in the last movie, how it can't really just start out like how all the other movies did, like the action movies, you know, like he's just going to town like usual.
Point being, like if in the superhero movies or things that are more sequential, where you like technically there's a series of narratives that stack on top of each other, the refusal of the return in the big story might appear as the refusal of the call in like a microcosm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They might blur with each other.
Yeah. Well, I got a couple more examples here too.
Okay. Keep going. Keep going.
Yeah. So basically, this one's not perfect by any means. But you know, if you think of like the climax of a movie where the heroes, it's sometimes like they defeat something, or it's like they sacrifice themselves and they think they're dead and they're in like a dream or something. I don't know. Like maybe kind of like Harry Potter, or I don't know. That kind of happened in the seventh book a little bit. You know. But I don't know. The scene that kind of comes to mind, but it's not in the right place, is Braveheart's at like the top of his game. So William Wallace is at the top of his game, like invading England and everything, peak of his power. And then all of a sudden he has a dream where like his dead wife is in there, and you know, he doesn't want to leave the dream and go back to the reality, but it's like he knows he kind of has to, and the wife even tells him he has to, and it's like, yeah, you got to go out and continue doing this mission or whatnot, you know, even though this is like the perfect moment for him again ever since she's died or something like that, you know.
Right.
The other example I was thinking like, what would it feel like for the apostles, you know, after the resurrection? So Jesus is back in like glorified form, and then, but eventually he's telling like, I'm gonna ascend to heaven, and but you know, that'll actually be better because, you know, the Holy Spirit will come and like fill you guys up and like energize you to go out and serve the mission. But you know, like I was specifically thinking of the end of John's gospel, which is like, how would it feel for St. Peter and St. John to be sitting there with Jesus? They're sitting on the Sea of Galilee. It's like a perfect sunny morning, and they're like near a fire cooking some fish, like hanging out with Jesus. And by this point, whether you're like, you're Christian or not, and you believe this stuff or not, I mean, at this point, these guys who wrote the Bible, who saw these stories, you know, lived with Jesus, they know at this point that he's God. And so it's like, why would they ever want that moment to end? But they know it has to end. You know, it's like, that is perfect bliss there. Like, they're in, yeah, it's heaven right on earth, because like the glorified Jesus is with them. But they know it has to end, and they know they have like a mission to do to go out into the world. Yeah, those are kind of my examples for that.
Well, yeah, I had one example that I'm now doubting myself on. I was going to say...
Oh, well, what's yours? Yeah.
Spirited Away. Well, okay, first of all, I'm going to say I tried to think of a ton of these, and this step is really hard to find. So I just want to defend myself a little bit.
But, okay.
Spirited Away, movie I love. I've mentioned it before for some of the random steps. It's a bit of a weird story, so it doesn't fit perfectly. But if you're familiar with the story, the main character, Sen, or Chihiro, is sort of trapped in this magical bathhouse. And she's in love with this guy who's like, it's basically a dragon, but she doesn't know that she's in love with him. And I guess it's not worth explaining the whole plot of the story. But towards the end of the story, she saves Haku, who's the dragon, and she basically pulls this like golden seal and this little black bug that were putting a curse on him. She pulls it out of his stomach. He vomits it up. And she takes it back to this other witch living out in the middle of the woods who had put the curse on Haku originally. And it's kind of a scary journey to be undertaking, and she does it with a few random characters she's met along the way. And then when she gets there, it's like this very quaint cottage in the middle of the woods, and it's nothing what she at all expected, and it's actually a weird sort of bliss when it seemed like the story was coming to a climax. And in this place, she's like she's totally removed from all of her struggles and challenges of the previous like place that she was stuck in, and she has the offer extended her to her to stay there, and she part of her wants to because it's really nice.
Yeah.
And she knows she has to go back, so she re-enters. So that was the first thing I thought of, but then I was like, wait a second, that's not really before the climax of the story. It might be the whole story, the whole thing plays out in this mystical world, and the climax is when she gets her parents back and returns to the real world, and she has to leave behind this thing that was like a dream, basically. And she has this hesitation where she is literally re-entering the real world, and has like a, wait, do I really know what happened? Do I really want to leave? Yada, yada. And I think that might be the refusal to return, like that paralysis before she goes back.
Yeah, I see with this stuff, I think it's kind of easy to find. It's just hard to find in the right place according to this order. Which I'd say, yes, we'll talk about it in a second, but I think we even have that problem in The Hobbit, honestly.
Yeah. So, okay, yeah. Hit us with the next Hero's Journey stuff.
All right, so the next step is Magic Flight. So, here's some notes I took. Okay, so if a trophy, so when we say trophy, sometimes, you know, these myths are quests for like an actual object or whatever, you know, but like trophy slash goal. So, mm-hmm, you know, it could be like the big game or, you know, the big fight, you know, they want it or whatever, you know,
right.
If the trophy has been attained against the opposition of its guardian, or if the hero's wish to return to the world has been resented by the gods or demons, then the last stage of the mythological round becomes a lively, often comical pursuit. So maybe it doesn't quite work in like a big game or like a big battle or something. So it is more specific, like if you have like an object or something, you get the object, you gotta escape. Before we do the Star Wars example, I think the most obvious example for me personally would be the Indiana Jones movies, where Indiana Jones finds the lost Ark in the first one, and then eventually it's stolen from him, so he's not really escaping with it, but he has like a long pursuit to get it back, you know, and that's kind of like right. The last movie, like, you know, he has a big car chase where he's pushing Nazi trucks off the road, and then, you know, he gets it back, and like they get on a boat, but then the Nazis take over the boat, and then like they start doing some ritual to go open it up on some Greek island, and they all get themselves killed except Indiana Jones is smart enough now, so then he ends up getting it back. So it's like that was a really extremely long version of the step, but that's one. But
uh-huh.
The Star Wars example, and I got one more example, one fun example after this. The Star Wars example, I think, is, all right, Luke's, you know, he's our hero. The quest is achieved. Vader became a good guy, but he's dead, and the Emperor was destroyed, which is good. But now Luke's got to get out of this danger zone because this Death Star is blown up. So he gets Vader's body, he gets on some ship and gets out of there, as the Death Star is blowing up. Meanwhile, this isn't quite, you know, the hero specific, but the friend of the hero, Lando, went into the Death Star to actually blow it up on the Millennium Falcon this time. So, I mean, and then he's got to escape as well. So I think that's where you'd hit the magic flight step in Star Wars.
Okay. That actually, and it is like a magic flight.
The fun example, best example I had, and hopefully I'm playing, you know, added in some music is The Sound of Music. I'm so pumped. I thought of a way to bring this up.
The series. Yeah.
Yeah.
Explain.
So, all right. So that movie, I don't know if it really follows Hero Steps, but it does this step throughout it. I mean, you know, that movie is like, I kind of like it because there's not a ton of overall drama throughout it. You know, but anyways,
right.
The dads wanted to like get Preston to, I think, Nazi military service again, but he doesn't want to do that because they're Austrian and, you know, they know the Nazis are bad. So they decide that they're gonna escape, but the government's watched them. So they do like this concert in front of the whole town because you know they're a big thing now. The Von Trapp family, you know, their show, and so they do the concert.
Right.
But then they're gonna after the concert, their plan is to run away and escape to Switzerland. As they get so first of all, they have to do the show and get out of there. So they do the show, get out of there, but then they're running away, and they know, like, the cops are on them and everything, so they go hide in the convent, which Maria was a part of, and then they're confronted with a couple of Nazis, specifically the oldest daughter's boyfriend, the 17 going on 18 kid, you know? And then, you know, just to bring in the comical part, you know, the nuns destroy the Nazi car so that they couldn't follow after them. They run, they get the car, and then family gets in the car, they drive out to the mountains, and then they know they have to hoof it on foot, so they walk and climb every mountain out of their way, out of Austria into Switzerland to get away to safety. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a pretty good example of the magic flight.
That is a good example. That, although, I would, just to mess with you, just to make it harder, couldn't that be also seen as the climax of the story, though?
No, don't go with climaxes with that movie, because there was, like, you know, she got married, she got, you know...
Okay, fine.
The kid respected her. That story wasn't very... It didn't have, like, an overall arcing point, if you ask me. I think that was more pure enjoyment. Which, yeah. That movie was awesome. Dude, alright, well, okay, I'll just say this now. You can say this later, but I did not like that movie when I was a kid. Like, I remember my mom trying to sit me down and watch that when I was like 7, and I was like, Mom, I'm 7. Why watch a movie where these kids are going to go play? I can just go play myself. I don't have to watch kids play. That's not entertaining. But then I was watching, I've re-gave it a chance in recent years, and that movie was funny because that's like the most believable musical ever. Like, yeah, okay, this crazy lady's going to show up. We're some uptight, weird family of 7 children. Okay, I guess we'll just follow our orders and have fun practicing musicals all day to impress our aloof father. Mm-hmm. And then also, what completely won me was when they did that Lonely Goat Herd puppet show. Like, I watched that, forgot that completely existed, and I was like, no way, this movie is so awesome.
I feel like I gotta go watch this now.
I know, I'm right?
I really don't know about this.
Yeah, 10 out of 10 movie.
Okay, I'll mark it down. All right.
Anyways, I guess we gotta get back to this
show. Yeah, okay, so...
We're running long. No, well, do you have any examples of Magic Flight, or no?
Honestly...
We can just keep going.
Yeah. I don't feel confident enough in any of my ideas. Like, it feels too convoluted to me.
Alright, transition us back into The Hobbit.
Okay, so how does all this relate back to Bilbo? Let's do it this way. Let me take a stab at it, because I think you've got a better grasp of these than I do. Let me take a stab at it, and then you jump in where you think that I'm totally wrong or might have gotten it right. So... I'm going to say Bilbo, the refusal to return, the most clear thing to me is he has like a at least the potential of momentary bliss at the men's camp after he talks to Bard and the Elven King, and they promise him, you know, you'll be treated with honor, you can stay here as long as you need to, you know, we'll protect you, etc. And there's physical comforts like warmth and food, etc., and metaphysical comfort like actual protection, and sort of it could be the end of his journey, which he has certainly longed for. And he feels all of this, and then he's like, "No, you know, I gotta get back to it. I have to return to my responsibilities." And then Magic Flight, this one I'm a little bit iffier on. It feels like maybe Bilbo is entering into a whole stretch of magic flight in the delivery of the Arwenstone, where he's kind of secretly fleeing from the dwarves and then running back to them. And for many intents and purposes, Bilbo is now a fugitive. And like part of the magic flight thing to me sounds like there's like a fugitive nature to the main character in this stretch, and Bilbo is now secretly in flight. We're just not really aware of it. I don't think that his flight was either to or from the camp.
So, I agree with you, but you're aware that you're switching up the steps. You're switching the order.
Help me out.
Well, because, I mean, the way we said it, refusal of the call, or refusal of the return should happen, and then the magic flight should happen, if we're being strictly technical about the order.
Yes, well, first of all, I'm not being strictly technical. I think there might be some confusion here in terms of order.
I think so, too. Or if we're going to, like, try to hit the steps, there has to be some sort of confusion in the order.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The refusal to return seems stronger to me, the case for that. The magic flight, like I said, I'm not sold on. But if it were, you could say that it starts at the instant that he hands over the Arkenstone, but I think it, like, he certainly seems in flight when he's leaving his night watch station.
Yeah, see, that's what I think, too. I think that one's pretty clear that that's the magic flight. You know, I mean, you don't have to have some sort of trophy or treasure or anything, but I think that helps in this step, and Bilbo does. He's running away with the Arkenstone from his group.
What makes me hesitate is that there's no pursuit, right? That's why I mean to say it's secret. Like, there's the fugitive nature to it, even though there's no pursuers.
Well, he does it magically, because, I mean, he's wearing the ring this whole time, and then he gets caught by the elves, and, I mean, he wanted to get caught, but, I mean, is it super magical or fugitive? More so than fugitive? No, but, you know, I think just the cunningness of it, going behind the back, the thrill of it, the adventure of it, I think that fits.
Okay.
I think that, like, I'm pretty confident to say we hit this step, this is where it is. Now, the other one, refusal of the return, I think comes kind of after, because it's like, all right, Bilbo could have handed over the Arkenstone, could have stayed with the elves and men, his adventure could have been over. He could have just lived, you know, in glory like that. But then again, that's not really glory with, like, his companions that he went on with it. He actually returned to them, even though, you know, like, this isn't going to be a blissful stay, you know, with
Thorin.
Yeah, by no means. And Gandalf even tells Bilbo, like, yeah, it's going to be a little rough in the near future for you, but, you know.
Yeah.
But so I don't think that one perfectly fits here, but I think shoe doesn't perfectly fit, but I think we kind of hit it.
Yeah.
He saw where he could just, you know, live happily for the rest of this adventure in the Men and Elves camp, but he returns to his friends, which we've already talked about, for noble reasons. Mm-hmm. It's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And any more thoughts?
No, I'm sold.
All right, Clifford, what is it? 2/19, 2019?
Mm-hmm.
How you been? How's your weekend? Big marathon? How'd it go?
It was good. Big marathon. It was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
Time? I finished just under 3 hours, so that was a little bit slower than what I've done in the past.
What was the exact time?
Like 2 hours, 59 minutes, and 45 seconds.
Wow. Well, what's your best? I know your best. I'm just letting you say it.
2 hours, 48 minutes and change. This was number 10, and I'm pretty. I'm not totally positive, but I think I've done 7, like between 2:48 and 2:52 or something.
Damn, consistency.
Consistency, but can't get faster.
All right. Well, what was your mileage for weeks going into this? What? Like, was it, like, was it over 50?
No. By no means. I mean,
wow, that's really good for under 50.
With the exception of when I was doing some really long runs, I was probably doing more like 30. Next one I do, definitely training. Yeah.
Dude, guess what? I just heard today Indiana Dunes is getting upgraded to a national park.
Oh, sweet.
So, anybody out there that, you know, wants to go to all the national parks, you gotta add another to your list.
Yeah. Also, maybe you should go there before the entrance rates, like, triple or something.
Or just get the pass. Like, the annual pass is like $80. All right, we got a review here. from
Sweet.
Yeah. Whoa, shoot. There are more reviews. Oh, I'll have to read them later.
You have to decide which one's best.
No, we got enough that I'll just spread them out over the
Lucky for
everyone. Alright, okay. Anyways, this one's from Tarumbar9393. So this guy's a Turin fan. He probably liked our Dragon special. Let me tell you.
Nice.
Alright. I have read the LOTR, The Hobbit, and The Silmarillion multiple times. Each read-through uncovers new and exciting discoveries that I missed before. This podcast is like a reread on steroids. The hosts really know their stuff and excel at taking the literature to a new level on the page and off. I can't wait for the show to reach the Fellowship of the Ring. Keep it up, Pat and Clifford. Oh,
sweet.
What a review. See, this is what we're talking about. We're getting up there. We're getting up there.
Cool, cool, cool.
Yeah, look at that. Turumbar9393, send an email to talkingtokenpodcast@gmail.com with your address, maybe your name, and then I'll ship you a beer koozie. Anything else for this one?
I don't think so.
All right, why don't we end it there? Because this episode, this Sound of Music one was like longer than usual, and it was also the shortest chapter, so we don't really have any excuse besides that we had so much good stuff to talk about. Girls in white dresses worth your time. So anyways, tune in next week, I guess. Thanks for listening.
Cool. Thanks, y'all. These are a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite.